Hey folks, just a heads up that there is a little bit of discussion about sexual assault in the first 15 minutes as it relates to the movies Tar and Barbarian. I put the time stamps, if you'd like to skip that, as well as for when we begin the book discussion in the description. Enjoy the show. Everybody, and welcome back to Girls Like Us. We are the podcast that asks, what does a literature degree get you? And we say that it gets you a podcast about books for children. We are joined today by the very real Lydia Tarr. She is real, and
she's real. You've never heard of her, but she's real.
Yeah. She's a household name. She's real, but you personally have never heard of you. And that makes you dumb and not cultured. And you should feel bad.
Yes.
I saw Tar like a week and a half ago at this point. Franny, you're reporting that you saw it yesterday.
Yes.
I will just go ahead and say that is a 3-hour movie that I liked.
Yes. You know, I will say this was, I don't know if I've talked about this on the pod, but we've had trouble leaving our dog alone basically since we've got her. May and I have not left the house together until this past week without a dog sitter, which is kind of insane.
That's hell.
Yeah, luckily with the right mix of little doggy anti-anxiety medication and a crate that she likes and feels comfortable in, we were able to leave her for 4 hours yesterday, and she just slept, which is awesome because normally she would be barking and howling. And yeah, she was all good. So, but that being said, we were going to see, the new Park Chan-woo movie, Decision to Leave. And we got to Music Box Theater and the line was literally down the block. And so we were like, Okay, I guess this came out today. Maybe there was an old woman being like her, I think sister was like, this line is like 700 people. And the woman was like, I don't care. I want to get in line. So instead we changed locations. We went to see Tar. And so, you know, it's a so that being said, like an almost 3-hour movie was a little stressful to me. I always turn my phone off at movies, but I did have my phone on just to see if there were any puppy cam notifications. But that was a little nerve wracking, but it all worked out. Tar, here's what I have to say about Tar. And this does not negate the fact that I liked it. I feel like the guy who wrote and directed it said, how could I make a Me Too or people sympathize with a Me Too-er? We got to make her a woman and a lesbian. Like, it felt a little bit like that because the arc was very much like, I don't know how much of her kind of manipulation of people into sexual situations basically was reliant on her being a woman or her being a lesbian. That doesn't mean I didn't like it, but I was like, yeah, you couldn't make like a people emphasize with a Me Too-er, for lack of a better term, if it was just about a random guy.
Right. But I think that's what's interesting about it in some ways, because I really think that it is like, there's not a lot of, because we don't see like, we see flashes of like her horrible behavior, right?
Yes.
But we don't see like, we don't see anything that, we don't see anything decisive in either direction, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's never like a scene where like you explicitly watch the kind of behavior that gets her canceled.
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of, at least my interpretation of it is that you're supposed to, it's like, however you might feel about like quote unquote cancel culture and the way that it operates like through the internet and across like generations, like that's what you are going to graft onto the movie because you don't see enough in a lot of ways to actually have like, this is what the movie's opinion of this person is. Like, I think it's pretty, and I think it's easier, that's an easier thing to do, one, with an actress as talented as Cate Blanchett, and two, with a woman in that role rather than a man. Like, it lends a sense of ambiguity to it that it would be probably, I mean, like, So one of my big issues with Barbarian was, well, one, I really liked Barbarian for what it was, but I think the movie would have been better if it would have been more unclear. Like, the whole time I was like, I knew what was going to happen between the Justin Long character and the main girl, right? Yeah. Like, I knew that he was in some way going to, like she was going to, like, give everything
to save him
in the tradition of Evan Hansen as Deer to save him. And he was going to, you know, like,
in the tradition of Pitbull, she was going to give him everything tonight.
Right. And I was like, I wanted it to be more unclear, like, to what level of an asshole he was. Right.
Right.
Because it's similar, because you don't see the actions or even specifically know of the actions that get him canceled. But then it cuts to that scene in the bar where he is very obviously describing a rape that he committed against somebody.
Yes.
And it's very obvious to literally anybody that that is a rape. And it's like, and I also just don't believe that anybody, like, that most people, especially folks who, like, until their 40s have existed in polite society, would ever describe something that way in such, like, such clear terms as a rape and, like, believe themselves to have done nothing wrong. Like, it seemed his assholeness was way too obvious to me. And what I liked about Tar was that it was, like, she was obviously, like, an asshole and, like, a manipulator and a bad person, but it existed so much more in, like, how that kind of person actually operates in the real world, which is, like,
kind of getting unchecked power until it is checked. And there's some complicity in the organizations, because we see kind of her, this isn't even really Tar spoilers. I mean, we see this happen, but, like, when these accusations do come to light, or even before that, this guy, like, her coworker being like, well, we all know that happens. Like, but it's only brought up when it is convenient. Right. So, like, and also the way that, like, as much as her assistant had been, like, she has this assistant throughout who is also a conductor, and who I think we are also to assume there was maybe a more, like, consensual romantic relationship there. We don't know, but there was at least that assistant is upset. It's implied that she is kind of on the outs with Tar and would like to be back in like a sexual manner. Like, I guess not consensual in the power dynamic, but it's not implied to be like a Weinstein situation necessarily. Like, it is implied to be a little more muddied in the way that she's manipulating the power dynamics.
Implied to be, as they are both in some ways manipulating the power dynamic. Obviously, Tar is manipulating the power dynamic more, and this girl is, you know, less, because she is the less powerful person in the situation. But yeah, it is. Yeah. Exactly.
But she goes along with it until, like, she too has some complicity in it, but because she is also someone who is, you know, sourcing and seeing how Tar is interacting with other people and is not doing anything about it, because ultimately, like, her thing is she wanted to get this conductor role after someone, the guest conductor role. So, I mean, I liked it. Sometimes a 2.5 hour movie can be good. So I think that's the first time you guys have heard us say that on this podcast. I did see a trailer for She Said before, which is the film about Weinstein. And it's just one of those things where you see, like, a shot of the guy playing Weinstein, I think, from behind. And it's like, how sad would that be to get a call from your agent and be like, you know, I think you might look good for Weinstein. Like, just like the most, like, disheveled looking man.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, he's had some sort of virus just for the last, like, 5 years.
Yes.
His, like, skin is falling off.
Right.
You would have to, I think, to see She Said, you would have to hold me at gunpoint and walk me into the theater. I hate journalism movies. I hate, like, movies about somebody, like, cracking the source and case, like, telling the story. I think journalists are so self-important, like, in those ways.
I've never seen,
like,
Spotlight, where it's, like, I will, like, say. Have you seen Spotlight?
Spotlight is, like, one of the worst movies I have ever seen. I, like, it is truly just, like, it's, like, it's one of those things where it's classic, like, movies about journalists, movies about lawyers, where it's, like, it totally decenters the fact that, like, people have been being actively victimized.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it's always the thing where it's, like, the journey of the journalist is to, like, get these people to talk and is to exploit them. And, like, the victims are often cast as, like, sort of the villains, where it's, like, we have to, like, manipulate this woman into telling us her story so that, like, we can make money and prestige off of it. And it's, like, I can never, ever be, like, I will never, ever feel bad for, like, a journalist, like, not getting somebody to talk. Like, that's just not a plot that I care about.
Right, like, in the trailer, we see, like, a woman, like, close the door on them, and then it's, like, were you silenced? Were you silent or were you silenced? And it's, like, well, in this situation, exactly. If someone is silent, that's definitely okay. Like, I mean, we're seeing these trials coming out. It's, like, I understand totally why these, you know, myriad of victims would not want to come forward. Though, apparently, Mel Gibson is going to testify. Did you see that?
I don't care.
Yeah, which is wild, like, against Harvey, which it's like, okay, that's whatever. Just, I feel like bad decision by the defense team on, or the,
you know what I call that?
On that, what?
You know what I call that? Tar on tar.
Tar on tar, more like rat on rat. I was impressed by the amount of, kind of, like, we see her be such an asshole and, like, see the way that she kind of, like, her intellect, which a lot of times, I mean, I was a little lost in terms, we see the vibe of what she's talking about, which is, I am smarter than you. But I was impressed by the way that the screenwriter crafted that faux intellectualism. Like, when she's reading this, like, paragraph from her book, and it's just like, this is just going over my head, but everyone in this room is pretending to like it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really good. It's very rare, obviously, that I feel like a movie that long is earned. I thought it was well paced. There was no time where I was, like, bored by it. And the scenes of her, like, conducting and doing the music, like, really do make the whole thing worth it. Like, that first cut to her conducting is, like, I think an iconic. Mm-hmm. Instantly an iconic movie moment.
I liked, I will say that, like, because we see her apartment, like, this Berlin apartment that is, like, made of concrete blocks, basically. And I kind of thought about the, you know, reddit.com/r/male living spaces, like, damn, some people live like this, like, guys, Tars will be having a cabinet with a metronome in it and a block of cement and call that a bedroom.
Yeah, I will say, though, that, like, as much as people wanted to say that the worst thing for body dysmorphia the week that movie came out was the was Taylor Swift stepping on the scale and it's saying fat. It was me having to watch the tailor cut that suit for Tar and knowing that my body would never look like that in the suit. The Tar measurements, really, like, that was kind of the golden egg in that movie for me, where I'm like, I don't want a body like Taylor Swift, honey. I want a body like Tar. Like, give me that. Like, Tar looked so good in all the clothes. When she's, like,
scrubbing her little naked body out.
Oh, my God. Like, incredible. The idea.
After she touches, like, a woman with, like, lesions on her.
Yeah. Incredible. I don't know. I really liked it. I thought it was really well done. And it's wild that a movie that long kept my attention. Because, like, even at the end of Barbarian, I was kind of like, all right, Justin Long, like, toss her off the water tower already.
Which,
like,
again, Barbarian is about 90 minutes. That's about
Like
an hour and a half less. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, see both of those movies. But I do think, because they are both ostensibly about cancellation and about masculinity, I do think they go well in conversation with each other. Maybe it's just because I watched them, like, within the same week.
Barbarian.
Yeah. But I feel like we're going to talk about today's book for a while, so we should just rip the Band-Aid and get to it.
Let's get into it. And I'm honestly, like, The Fault in Our Stars, in terms of realistic YA fiction, I don't think we can name a more contemporary or a more influential book
No.
that was kind of contemporary to our teen years. I read this book as a teen and I don't remember explicitly like loving it. I liked Paper Towns a lot in terms of John Green books. The Fault in Our Stars was not my favorite. I saw the movie, which we kind of, weirdly, we didn't touch on this in the Insurgent episode, is that Shailene Woodley and Ansel Elgort did go directly from playing brother and sister to playing love interests, which is kind of funny. Like probably at the same time that they may have been, I think Shailene Woodley came either straight from the Insurgent shoot to the Fault in Our Stars or vice versa, because she had to have that haircut.
Yeah.
And I did read this and I cried a lot yesterday because this is harder to read as an adult than it is as a teen. And also I think the last time I read this, like I had not been in a relationship. And the thing, like this book is like I do have to kind of give it up to John Green. I mean, we make fun of him, like the world makes fun of him, but he does kind of capture in a lot of ways how much life sucks and how kind of we're just, you know, we have to deal with that. Like we cannot control anything. Like, yeah.
I have complicated feelings towards this book because I feel like it is technically very well done. Like it is much tighter than I remember it being.
Yeah.
It is a quick,
it's kind of a quick read, even though it's like 300 pages.
Yeah. It's a quick read. It's really well structured. There's not a lot of fluff. I agree that the rendering of the love story is very real. And I, you know, like, sure, giving teens the space to realize that life is, you know, as the book says, the world is not a wish-granting factory. And life is ultimately, like, us trying to find enjoyment in, like, just, like, the bad things that repeatedly happen to us and those around us. But at the same time, it is, like, the fucking John Green voice is so cloying and inescapable. Like, I just really, and I get that that's like a personal taste thing because I love this book as a teen. When I felt like I was better than other people for reading books, you know what I mean? And it's just like reading it back. And I get that, like, what he's doing as an adult writer is so much more obvious and you can only pick up on this reading as an adult, which is the fact that teenagers are inherently annoying and teenagers do think they're smarter than everybody around them. And that is in here and that is clearly intentional. It just does not, like, I don't know. I don't even know if I can articulate it, but like, I just, it's like, it's so annoying. Like, it's just so fucking irritating.
I think it grated on me a lot less because when we covered, like, Looking for Alaska, it stuck out there a lot. And kind of the male gaziness of that, even though it was somewhat recognized, like, by John Green, I think, as he was writing it, like, it was definitely intentional. However, the male gaziness of that made it a lot worse. I do think he writes better from a female perspective. And another kind of reason that I think it was less grating to me is you can excuse it a lot more when it is coming from a girl in Hazel's situation. Did you think at all about, like, it's just now that I'm realizing this, like, could there be an argument for exploitation with this? Because obviously, like, you know, in a lot of ways, when a child is sick, there's a lot of people who can profit off of that.
Yes.
And who can use that in arguments, political, emotional, otherwise, without a lot of deference to the actual child or teen that sickness is happening to. In a lot of ways, I thought that this kind of, in many ways, Hazel is dealing with, I think, the realization that many people have as adults about mortality and that's in contrast with what most teens feel, because a lot of teens feel invincible.
Right.
Maybe not nowadays, but I knew a lot of teens who feel like I can do anything.
Well,
like,
that's just how your brain
is. The world is my oyster. Yes. But yeah, I don't know. How did you feel about?
No. Yes.
I mean, there's kind of a meta text. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things to loop into this conversation. One, it is a very frank and good sort of you know, subsummation of the way as you mature, like, you have to start to think about your own mortality, which in this case happens to a teenager because she is, you know, actively dying. And I think it's like, that's good. It's like, so the other thing to note here is that there was, and I don't know if you, this is a big part of the sort of metatextual thing of like followers of John Green know about this book, which is that he developed a friendship with a girl who was the inspiration for this character who died before he wrote the novel.
I did not know about that.
Yes.
But I remember because they told, she had a biography or something that was out after this.
She, like he published under his publishing company, like for charity, like a collection of her diaries. And so it's like her, there's a lot of her imported into this character. And like they had like a long running, like epistolary friendship. And then she died, like she had the same type of cancer that, the main character in this book has. And she died when she was like 16. So that kind of, you know, like, do I think that's complicated morally, question mark? Maybe. Do I think that it's like how anybody writes a book? Also, yes. I just don't like, here's the thing is like, we know that John Green, especially in our era, like he sort of conjured this entire like militia essentially of like young female readers who were totally saw themselves in his books and totally, you know, like he was like an icon of this period. And I guess my question still is just like, why? And then like, how does that operate? And I don't think, sorry, I'm rambling a lot because I just, I feel so complicated about this. I don't think this book is misogynistic. This book has like,
it has influenced, I mean, the, more than to me, more than Twilight, more than The Hunger Games, these other iconic books that we talked about. I mean, this was the way that wormed its way the most into my brain and in our culture, I think. And, I mean, it was just a phenomenon and, I think I totally get the rambling on this because it's, there's a lot of thoughts that we're trying to explain that we've had like since we were, you know, 16.
Yeah. It's just very like, I think that he gets very close to his intention here, which is like the main thing that I saw in this book, the main thing I was tracking in this book, which I think is the best part of this book, is something that I never picked up on reading it as a teen, which is Hazel, the main character's obsession with knowing what happens. Like this, the obsession with this book, like, so the whole thing is that she's obsessed with this fake book that's made up for the sake of the novel, The Fault in Our Stars, called An Imperial Affliction. She's obsessed with this book. The author, who now lives in Amsterdam, only ever wrote one book, which was An Imperial Affliction. And it's about a young woman with cancer who, like, essentially dies mid-sentence at the end of the book. And Hazel is obsessed with knowing what happens to the other characters in the end, which is obvious now as an adult reader, is that that obsession is her grappling with her own mortality, right? Like she
what
knows
happens when I die.
Exactly. Yeah. Like she knows intellectually that like she is going to die soon. So she is obsessed with knowing what is going to become of her parents, what is going to become of her friends, what's going to become of everybody else around her, because she, like all of us, feels this human need to sort of control those things so as to protect other people. And it is through the relationship that she forms with the love interest that causes her to realize that life is all about essentially loving people, and like anybody can die at any moment. So like, you know, that love is what powers, rather than this sort of like this need for control, this need to know what's going to happen, this need to protect others, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think that's a really good, like, that really is strong. That really comes out through the narrative. It's just these like hyper cringe, like romance elements that really just like I find to be very grating. And
yeah, and let's go into that, because like the problem there is Augustus. It's not necessarily Hazel,
right?
Yeah. Well, in terms of like, I don't know, in terms of characters that are the most compelling, it's definitely not Augustus,
no.
right? The friend Isaac, who has eye cancer and loses his second eye and becomes blind, like that's a, but at the time, like, he's both, he flip-flops kind of between being overly concerned with his breakup with this girl named Monica, who left him because she was essentially like, I can't dump you after you, like, you go blind, like, I can't do that, like, right. I'm gonna just end this now. And he's kind of struggling with both, you know, obviously becoming blind and entering into having a disability that he didn't have previously, all for the sake of like, you know, like staying alive, basically. And he like, and that's very interesting too, to see like how like his teen problems converge with his like mortality problems, and then also just like he likes playing video games, right? Like
right.
I found that to be a much more accurate representation. And then beyond that, also people's parents are really compelling in this, because I think as an adult, like you can relate to the parents as well, even if you don't have children. Like a big turning point with Hazel and her mom's relationship is Hazel, she calls it the miracle, but when she was 12, after she was diagnosed with the cancer, her lungs filled up with fluid to the point where they thought she was going to die, but they were able to save her. And then she went on this drug, and this drug like has kept her tumors at the same size, even though we know as a reader, like she is not going to have a long life. We know the tumors are going to come back and they're going to grow again. But as she's dying, or as her parents think she's going to die, she hears her mom say to her dad, I'm not going to be a mom anymore. And that is like, obviously like you would not want your child to hear that, but that's like a relatable feeling, right?
Yeah.
Like if she feels like this is the one thing that defines her, like, I also like, I don't know, like Hazel's feeling towards Augustus is much more interesting than Augustus, the character. And in terms of like both the parental child relationship and Hazel's relationship to Gus, like when she sees him at the funeral, it's an open casket, and she says to him, she's like, I love you, present tense. Like, and I liked that, because that was, I think, a better summation of grief.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that this was a very real type of grief, because a lot of times, like, well, yeah, it's sad. And like, even for like, you know, not that I was particularly close with like, any of my grandparents who have passed away, but like I'll have like dreams about like my grandpa and feeling like, oh yeah, it was just a mistake, you're actually alive,
yeah,
right? Like that type of thing, where it's like your feelings don't go away for a person just
right.
because they are no longer physically here. And that's more of the hard thing about grief than it, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's I felt like it got at the complication of grief very well. However, Augustus, the character, is like, dude, if you didn't have cancer,
I'd beat your ass. Like, full
stop.
Pissed
off at you.
He's so irritating.
Yeah. He's like trying to like fuck her in the basement. Like,
part of me, and that's a, like, is so complicated about my feelings towards this book. Part of me is like, mm-hmm. you know, that's a really good rendering of that character, because the point is, you know, that these are just normal, annoying teens who happen to, you know, be in this horrible situation where they're both actively dying. And then the other part of me is like, this is just like the classic John Green protagonist that is like, you know, like John Green's belief of them seems to be that they are like so intellectual and like so cool that they're incapable of being total like
dickwads.
Dicks, yeah, but like really they're just like
yeah
pretentious douchebags. And it's just like, it, like, reading it is exhausting. And it's, I don't know, the whole thing just goes back into the, my general feeling, which is that this is nobody's fault. And like, it's not bad to do this, but like, there's a lot of money to be made off of writing a book for teens that is very sad and where bad things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's true. You know, what's interesting now is, like, I think as an adult, too, you can, not that it's falseness in their relationship, but you can see how their relationship is a set of circumstances.
Oh, right.
Like, this is not necessarily, it's not that Hazel is so intriguing that Augustus just can't help but fall in love with her. It's like they are connecting on this very specific thing. And it's not that he's, like, such an amazing boyfriend to her or anything. Like, it's a pretty typical teen relationship in that he's immediately, you know, trying to get in her pants and then is kind of creating some, like, I liked the her feeling like, okay, like, now I feel like I owe him something because he's using his make-a-wish on me to go to Amsterdam. And even like the, like, when they have sex, like, I like that it was described as, like, not necessarily like being this groundbreaking, like, life-changing thing. It's just, I mean, she feels comfortable with it and it happened, but ultimately, like, it doesn't impact their relationship that much or how she feels about herself.
Right.
I mean, of course there's the classic, like, what do you mean I'm beautiful? Like, I'm beautiful? Like, how would you ever even think that? Like, that type of thing.
Yeah, I just fucking hate that.
Yeah, exactly. But they are, like, I do feel like in a certain way, especially in this book, like, that is realistic to these teens.
Right, exactly.
And I also liked the discussion of his past girlfriend who had, like, a brain cancer where it was, like, you know, part of her, like, you know, whatever the part of her brain that, like, filters out thoughts, like, had the tumor in it. Like, and so she just became, like, an asshole. And it's, like, yeah, like, how much, and also the way that it's very difficult when you have a diagnosis like this, like, you cannot separate that from yourself. It's, like, you are your illness. Like, your tumors are made up of your body. Like, your body is working against you. And that's, like, such a hard thing, I think, too. Accept and deal with. And, like, even as far as our modern medicine has gone, every, you know, if you get a virus, that's not you. If you get a bacteria, it's not you. It's like, okay, if you're born with a mental illness, that is kind of you. If you're born with any, most diseases, most afflictions, that is part of you. And, like, that's something I struggle with, like, right, like, with my, like, OCD and stuff. It's like, I know it's not me. I know this is just something I was born with, but it's hard when something lives in your body every single day to be like, to separate. Like, you can't.
Right. No.
You can't as a person separate yourself from that. So I think it dealt with that pretty well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it just ultimately, like, the stakes in this book are a lot higher than the stakes in some of John Green's other books. And I think that worked in favor of kind of letting me be like, okay, like, I can let this kind of asshole-y teen boy slide a little more than I would be able to in his other works.
Right. You know, and because teen boys are assholes, like, that's the thing, is like, you can't criticize it without, like, saying that it just, you know, like,
yeah,
I guess that is a real thing. It's just like, I don't know. I'm trying to put my finger on, like, the, like, just the level of, like, I don't know. It's very tough. Like, I don't want to call it, like, self-importance or, but it, like, it really is these, like, deep sort of spiritual musings that ultimately, like, how do you reckon with the fact that, like, it's like, okay, yeah, like, the book is like John Green, like, some author bio, like, he, like, what, like, he studied, like, religion and, like, spirituality and, like, even was, like, going to maybe go to divinity school. So, like, these questions are very interesting and important to him. But then also it's, like, this, like, sort of classic, like, pithy teen romance. And, like, they both exist in this book. And it's just, there's, I guess there's, I don't know, like, there's just part of me that's just, like, this is just all so fucking dramatic. Like, can we take it down? Yeah. Can we take it down a level? Like, I understand that this is a very real thing that does happen, but that doesn't take it away from the fact that like this novel very much is writing into the tradition of like teen tragedy novels, right? Like, and there,
give me some other examples of teen tragedy novels.
So like teen tragedy, not necessarily novels, but like the, like when I was a kid, there was, well, one teen tragedy novels, think about, like 13 Reasons Why.
Yes.
Like.
So Looking for Alaska.
Looking for Alaska. The one where the girl, like, the, all of the like Nicholas Sparks novels where like, it's like, like the high schooler like dies, and then, like, also just in general.
Jodi Piccolo books.
Yeah, like, Jodi.
I've always talked about that one, 19 Minutes, that truly scarred me for life in many ways.
Yes, like, the, and then also just, like, in general, the sort of, like, the chicken soup for the teen soul, the,
And we, that's true, because that's a good point. I didn't even think about that, but, like, that's a real life thing, and we've definitely talked about this on before, but, like, how unreadable those were, and how it's, like, in what way it, like, I think there's a, there has kind of been a cultural conception in that wanting that catharsis.
Yes.
And like things aiming at that catharsis. But it's like the idea that it's called Chicken Soup for the Soul, about warm and comforting stories. And then you read it and it's like, my stepdad was molesting me. And
right. And then
I didn't tell my mom. And it's like, that's the real story. It's right. Like, how is this?
And then like,
it's the, aiming for catharsis or tragedy. Tragedy porn is
exactly.
Is,
and like, there was a segment in like Girls Life magazine that was not in Boys Life magazine when I was a kid. This was exclusive to Girls Life magazine that was called, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before because it's so interesting to me from like a literary perspective, called The Worst Day. It was in the back of the magazine and it was like a tween girl did
it's
a
like
little,
you've only lived for like 12 years. Yes. So it'll get worse, honey.
A tween girl wrote about the like, the worst thing that ever happened to her in her life. And it was like, my friend died, or like, my brother is paralyzed now, or like, my, like, I was, oh, there was one where a girl was held hostage.
That's like, pretty bad.
Yeah, right. And it's like all of these things where it's like tragedy porn is, okay. I think I just got to maybe where my rub is.
Your brain
tragedy
dead, yeah.
Porn, why is tragedy porn pushed and consumed
onto teens?
Not teens, teen girls. Why is it pushed so specifically at girls? Why are we seen as the sort of the carriers of catharsis, of that emotional capacity to understand and intellectualize with grief? As young people were like that, I literally got there when I realized that Worst Day segment was in Girls Life magazine and not Boys Life magazine.
It was not in Boys Life.
We are
the worst. My worst day was when my mom didn't ignored the warning Jason's Only Zone sign on my room and came in and told me I had to do homework instead of playing pizza or eating pizza, playing video games and annoying my sister.
My worst day was when I heard something gay happened in the locker room and I had to kind of like cut two friends out of my life for acting gay. Like, we are conditioned and interpolated at such a young age to bear this tragedy, the grief, sort of the weight of life. And it's like, and it's so specific to me that this book where John Green says, I'm going to write about grief, death, dying, and like the worst fucking thing that could happen. And also it's going to be my first book that I write from a female perspective.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that I'm thinking as you're saying that is like, you know, there's always the trope, like girls mature faster than boys. And a lot of that is because girls have the world kind of thrust upon them and are expected to carry that at an early age. So while boys have to be almost, let's, in terms of like a publisher's mind, boys have to be informed about those little like tragedies that they go through throughout life, where girls, it's like, well, of course you've dealt with, you know, being sexualized already. Of course, right. you've dealt with being seen as less as. So let's push a bigger thing onto you and see if you can handle that. Like almost like it's like we need to level up for girls versus for boys. They're just allowed to kind of exist.
Yes.
And also like what is more tragic than a young pretty girl dying?
Yes. But even the ways that the characters in this novel divide among gender and how they deal with, like, mm-hmm. the grief of the given situation. Like, when Isaac gets yes. his second eye cut out, like, or finds out that, no, when Isaac's girlfriend breaks up with him as he is about to get his, as he is about to get the surgery that is going to render him mm-hmm. from partially blind to fully blind, he, like, Hazel goes over to the house as a means of comforting him, where him and Augustus are sitting there together playing video games, because that's how men yeah. share emotional intimacy, right? Like, I even see it with my yeah. My boyfriend and the relationships he has with other people. A lot of the most intimate moments that he shares, and, like, having, like, he doesn't have, in a lot of situations, like, picking up the phone and calling his friends. They get online and they play video games together.
Boys like activities.
Yes.
Boys like to do activities.
They have to have an activity.
Fresh. Even adult men sometimes just like to do activities. So you try to connect, you try to, and it's like, well, why don't we just do this activity instead? Wow. That's why I think we feel that, see the trope of, like, you know, men are like, let's watch football together. Like, yes. that's an activity. And that right. is bonding. Like, that is their love language. But
right.
Unlike, and that is obviously, like, a stereotype, but, like, I do think that is what is thrust upon them as being like, no, this is how you bond.
Yes.
You don't bond via conversation and talking. You bond via watching the big game or grilling a dog.
Right.
Like, it's like, you guys are just doing, like, it's like, the, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, you know, like, as Augustus, as, you know, the whole book, like, the first three quarters of the book, it's like, the whole thing is, how is Augustus going to deal with the fact that me, the main character, Hazel, is imminently approaching death? And then it turns into,
yeah,
he has a, you know, a resurgence of his cancer, and he's, like, you know, within 10 days facing death. And it's like, the way that he deals with it even is through these sort of, like, silly, like, almost more like bucket listy challenges rather than, like, the spiritual thing. And I think there's actually a really good scene where, like, you know, when they're in Amsterdam together, and he says, like, you know, it's like something I stress about, or that bothers me, is this idea of dying not in service to something else or someone else. Like, mm-hmm. I want to die in the line of, you know, not the line of, like, military duty, but in the line of some duty, in the line in relation mm-hmm. to some responsibility. And it's like, that is, like, sort of probably, like, a male feeling, and Hazel gets upset because she's like, well, I'm, like, actively dying, and it's like, my death, you know, doesn't mean anything. It's just me being sort of consumed by my illness. And, like, so I see that there's probably some awareness of that. I just, it feels very intentional to me that the grief journey has to be done through a female persona rather than mm-hmm. the male persona. Like, he just sort of dies. Yeah,
it's all very bleak.
Yeah.
There's also, like, there was kind of a discussion in the book, and making sense given John Green's kind of experience with religion and background, but about Hazel basically saying, like, no, I don't believe in God or an afterlife, and Gus saying, well, I do. And that is also kind of indicative, I feel like, of what we're talking about, of the way that these tragedy porn is marketed upon teen girls, is because, I don't know, and I hope that this doesn't, like, offend anyone. This is just how I feel, like, with my feelings with religion, having grown up in, like, not a super religious household, but, like, going to church and being involved with that, is that I think the more, and I think some people are probably going to find this opposite, but the more tragedy I experience in the world, the more bad things I see happen, certainly the less likely I am to believe in God, you know,
right,
because, like, it's like, in what, why would this happen? Like, and it's like, I can't, how am I going to put faith in someone who lets all this happen? And I know the argument there would be, like, you know, they don't or whatever, but, you know, with every school shooting, with every act of terrible racism, like, that's all I can think, right? It's like, it sucks. In my mind, I'm like, it sucks that we live in a world without God. Like, I really wish I could believe in this thing to have comfort, but I can't.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of indicative of the way that Augustus in some ways finds comfort in external circumstances in a way that it's impossible for Hazel to do So, and I don't know if that's because maybe the teen boys in this are a little bit reduced less to their cancer. And that's Hazel kind of is reduced to it. Like that becomes her whole life. And it's like, yes, these boys, obviously they have cancer, but they're kind of allowed a little bit like girlfriends. And like, you know, her friend is like, oh, I see Gustus at parties all the time. Like he's so hot. Like those characters are allowed a little more of a full, well-rounded teen life than Hazel is. I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the point that they are more definitely more so like kids than than she is. I think part of that might be owing to the fact that she is, you know, to look at it in the most sort of giving the most deference, part of it might be owing to the fact that she's the narrator. And so we have to like, we have to learn about this world of sickness and disability through her and her experience. So she's thrust into more of those experiences than they are. And also just like who she is as a character in her specific circumstances. But I definitely agree with that. I think that the, like, I almost wish that that sort of like spirituality, religiosity conversation didn't happen in this book. I see why it has to, because it's just so simplistic, like in so many ways, right? Like any conversation, at least in my opinion, about like the existence of like God or some, you know, equivalent, you know, in that the intersection of that with like organized religion is like, I just am like, I don't want it. Like, throw it out. Like, I don't want, I just could not, like, it's just not a, it's something when you touch on it so briefly in a book that is just like ultimately like stupid and distracting. And it's like, and I also just don't like the problem too, is that like, I don't care about what these characters think about things because they're so young and annoying. And that's partially the tragedy of their lives being so short, is they are afforded no opportunity to grow out of their annoying teenage bullshit.
I think also like, also in talking about like the way that teen girls bear tragedy, like Hazel has to, we see Hazel consider her parents and how her parents will feel once she dies way more. And her saying like, I want to reduce the amount of collateral damage I do when I die. We don't see, in fact, we see kind of Augustus do the opposite of like, it's my life. Like, I don't want to have to do chemo.
Right.
Like, I want to go to Amsterdam. Like, I don't care what you think. It's my life. Versus Hazel doesn't really get to do that.
No,
you know?
That's very true. Like, that's very true. Yeah. Like we see him sort of storm out of the house to go on this trip to Amsterdam rather than seeking treatment that would surely be life extending by telling his parents essentially it's none of your business. And it's like, well,
keep out. Gus's zone, keep out.
Right. It's just, I don't know. I guess I'm not mad at this book so much as I am mad at just the existence of a media ecosystem and predominant narrative that is like, in order for us to induct people into adult life, they have to read like novels that are bent on making you cry.
Yeah. Did you cry reading this?
I did not cry reading it this time. I'm sure that I cried reading it as a kid.
I cried reading it this time for real.
Yeah. I mean, it is really sad. Like, I just do not like, I think it's just because I remember it so well. I think the last time I read this was probably like only like, 6 or 7 years ago.
Do you remember any of the conversation around it?
Oh yeah.
Cause I feel like a big thing that was to me, like did not come out that much in my reading of this, but I remember like the okay
so stupid.
that was and that was everywhere. I mean, that was the number one thing I remember. Almost also, you we also see every teen girl's dream here, many teen girls' dreams, which is the idea of a relationship that is special and different. That is, those things are hard to come by when you are maybe dating other teens. So there's like that fantasy too, of even if this relationship isn't perfect necessarily, like they have something different that defines it. They have.
Yeah.
And he's obviously so in love with her, like from the moment. And that was interesting too. Like when he's like, I love you. It's like, one thing that was interesting is like, I think that the way that they love each other is different. And like his, I love you, I think is like, he does love her, but he also loves her for that he's leaving an impact on her.
Right. Yeah. He's obsessed with her. Like,
yeah, exactly. And so he is obsessed with her the whole book. And that's, you know, also not something that, I mean, some teen girls experience it, but like that's something that people, you might desire, right? Like, oh, this boy loves me so much no matter what.
Right. Like that's, I think that, you know, it's very natural to like love, be like swooning over like a, you know, it's like, it is the, you know, referenced explicitly in the book, the sort of the star-crossed lover narrative. I just like my issue. Well, one, the conversation around this book and then the movie during like the Fault in Our Stars mania from like, you know, 2013 to like 2015 was fucking exhausting. Like,
yeah.
And I'm not even saying that I didn't participate in it, because I did. Like, obviously, I was a John Green fan. I had little else going for me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Were you a nerd fighter?
Absolutely. And I'm ashamed to admit it. So I deserve like a prize for admitting that today on this podcast. But, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I was a very, like, I felt like a really strong sense of like loneliness and anger from when I was about like 15 until when I was like 17, just because like my family moved. I didn't feel like I had like friends that like understood me. I felt like I was like smarter and more enlightened than other people that I was going to school with. I felt like I was not having the opportunity to participate in conversations in real life that like I wanted to participate in. I felt sort of judged and shunned for being ugly, which, you know, I should have been, because ugly people should not be allowed in polite
society. Yeah, we've said that so many times on this podcast. Yes,
exactly. And we believe that. And we also believe that if you're rich, you're not allowed to have problems. And if you go to private school, it's bad. Those are all fast.
And if you're pretty, then you can't be smart. No. Put those all together.
Put those all together. Those are all opinions that we definitely have and are black and white true that we believe. So all of those things. So I found, like, I really liked the sort of John Green specifically and, like, Hank Green videos about, you know, because it's, like, it presents this idea of adulthood that, one, like, they're both, both of the Vlogbrothers are, like, man babies. Like, it's similar to sort of, like, the appeal that I would say dumber people have towards the Try Guys. Yes, where it's like, it's a model of adulthood that is not
fantasized.
Yes.
It's like the idea that like you have it as a kid, like, well, I could eat candy all day.
Exactly.
It's like, that's what the Try Guys do that. Right. They get to try every single candy in one sitting.
Right. Like, it's this idea that adulthood is just teendom with like more resources and more time.
And you get to fuck.
And you get to fuck. And you get to, like, yeah, like drink and do drugs, right? Like, the idea that you're going to become an adult and suddenly the oppression of teendom is going to slide off of you with little to no consequences.
Yes.
And so I felt that.
Instead of, we learn that you carry the pain of teendom with you, and then you also have to, like, pay taxes and, like, worry about your parents dying.
Yes. And, like, you have to, like, go to work, and like your job is like probably going to suck in a lot of ways. And like you, like most of the people you know and your friends like are actually not working in a field that like has anything to do with what they studied in undergrad and like maybe felt some passion towards at any point in time, right? Like everybody's just trying to get by. You have so many responsibilities that like you don't have time to like make a YouTube video being like,
this is how you suck a clit.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch that video?
No. Is that real?
I think that they like talk about like, he's like, her clitoris, focus on the clitoris. Like this was something in a John Green or Hank Green video about like, how do you make a girl come? Like what is, like, he's definitely said something about it. I mean, and of course there's also the, and no, he did not say this, but the Tumblr era thing of, you know, I love the taste of cock. More so than that, I love balls. That was attributed to him, that it looked like it was coming directly from his blog.
It's really funny.
I'm going to look up the clit thing because I know it's prominent.
But yeah, so it's like, that's very appealing to a teen. This idea that you're all of a sudden just going to enter a space that's all intellectual discourse in a fun way with no consequences. And like, you're going to have freedom. You're only going to have to hang out with people who are like cool and get you. Like, so,
yeah,
but it's like, it goes to my general, not like moral judgment, but like my general sort of like discomfort in questioning of like you, like being an adult man whose primary cultural consumers are teen girls. I'm not saying that that's like, oh, like groomer vibes or anything. That's mm-hmm. absolutely not what I'm saying. I'm saying like
tar vibes.
Yeah. I'm saying more like the level of like mind shaping and mm-hmm. like money return that you're getting off of that is overall, I'm like, I don't think anybody should have that power. And it's like, it's always right. a man, right? Like mm-hmm. Stephenie Meyer was not a cultural, like herself, like a cultural juggernaut. Like John Green pretends like, oh, I'm just this little writer nerd boy. But really it's like, he is a media empire. You know, he exists, he has his fingers in all different types of content pots. And it's like the refusal mm-hmm. to sort of acknowledge that in a real way outside of false modesty is just like, it's just odd. I think it's odd. And it's, and I don't think that he's actually, the other thing, I don't think he's actually that smart. I don't, like, it's like, it's the person you know who like loves to like I was at a party, like literally the one of the last parties, probably the last party I went to before COVID lockdown. Mm-hmm. So 3 years ago at this point. And, you know, I'm not a good person. This story doesn't have me coming across looking great. But I was working a ton at the time. I was on my feet all day. I was like, I had kind of a thin trigger at this time. And there was this girl there who always mm-hmm. frustrated me. And I was sitting on the couch having a drink. I think I might have even been in her home. And she started to say something, basically being like, I love Shakespeare. The thing about Shakespeare is that I love Shakespeare. And I literally told her to shut the fuck up and that we were not going to I was not going to participate in a group conversation about Shakespeare. Like, and John Green is like the same vibe where it's like everything is like, everything is not actually analysis. It's just tied to illusions within the Western canon.
Yeah. What do you think about, before we wrap up, like the device of having a meta book in this book and of wanting to find out how the story ends, because I kind of, you know, reading about John Green and how he came up with this, he also says that he had started a book that was kind of similar when he was like 22, but it was centered around him basically.
Right.
Like I do feel like there's a little bit of self-reflectiveness with the character of Peter Van Houten, who is an asshole, and of kind of the realization of that, how much adults can be kind of the arbitrator of teen feelings and how you have to kind of, I guess, wield that power responsibly.
No, I mean, I think that that kind of goes into my thesis of him being not actually that smart, because I think that jest towards self-reflexiveness is good. Like, I think the use of the meta-narrative here is a very good, creative, and ultimately, like, I think it ultimately works. But I think that there's a depth that it lacks in that there's nothing, like, like, it seems to speak more to absolve because of the extremeness of that character's bullshit. And then the fact that he sort of comes around at the end rather than, like, why can't it just be that he's an asshole and they never hear from him again? Or why can't it be that he's a little bit less of an asshole?
I think that it's because I think that character, because we learned then that that character was an asshole and who wrote this book, An Imperial Affliction, had a daughter die when she was like seven or something. And so I think some of that is also to say like that Hazel is tired of kind of adults using her as a symbol. And that's something that she discovers by the end of this book is a little more personhood than maybe she's been granted before, just because like she's the center, like, you know, she talks about how she has this big cancer team meeting and it's like, how much do they care about Hazel Grace, the person, versus Hazel Grace, the sickness and what she represents, right? Like, we don't know.
Right.
And I think so the Peter Van Houten thing is like also like her, well, having empathy for him because she says like, you know, his daughter only lived till seven, like what he would have given to have her live as long as Augustus lived, right? Like, but also being able to be like, hey, like, I'm going to put my foot down. Like, I'm not going to let you kind of put me in this place or define my personhood or define me as just like a mirror image of your teen girl or your child who died.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it does work. I don't know. I just like, I have this real, like, just this knee jerk feeling to be like to just be so irritated with like the whole John Green thing and just the book in general. And like the way that
because he did have kind of a grasp on the realistic YA fiction cultural canon.
Yes.
And that's kind of hard to get around.
Yeah.
Because we were in that. And it's like, should one man yield that much power to define what teens are reading? No.
No. And also the sort of the fact that it's like the reluctance to wield that much responsibility when like that's the whole thing. Right. And the fact that
that's the reality.
Yeah. The denial of it. And the like, it's all just very like, it's all very dumb man to me. Like, it's just, I don't know. I do have to say, too, before we wrap up, that the amount of people who named their child Hazel Grace has ricocheted.
And you know what? I hope you get... This is what the parents are saying. Like, and maybe one day you'll grow up and you'll have teen cancer too.
Yeah. The amount of people, like I saw a TikTok recently, like it has ricocheted to the point where people like in like deep, like Christian vlogger Alabama are naming their daughters Hazel Grace. And it's like, they almost certainly have not read the book, but like it exists in the ether enough that they're like, gonna name, you know, they name their child that the second they become inseminated and then like post about it on Instagram for the rest of the pregnancy and make us all subject to it. Which I guess it's just like with any book that is as big as this book was and is, it's just annoying to be a part of the larger, you know, the larger wave.
Yeah. And I think it's less understandable than like Harry Potter or like Hunger Games or Twilight, because it's like, well, those have fantasy elements. Like, why are these books that are, many of them are rooted in tragedy? Like why do these kind of have the same, for lack of a better term, like fantasy appeal that these other books have? Like,
right.
Like, should we be kind of encouraging teens to have that world? But because like the vast people of, you know, people who read this, like, do not have cancer.
Right.
Are not teens with cancer. And John Green also wasn't a teen with cancer. Not saying that he couldn't understand it, because I do think, like, that there is a chronic illness, like, as a long thing, like, something that, obviously, cancer is a more extreme version of this, but the way that Hazel thinks about herself and thinks about her illness is, I think, quite informed and elevated and realistic. Instead of like kind of what maybe if you were a teen with cancer, what adults would want you to feel about that of like, no, you're a fighter, you're a survivor, even though she's like, well, I'm just like living, I'm just trying to live my life. Like,
right.
I don't want to be those things necessarily. Like, how can I fight something that feels like it's intrinsic to me and my life? But like, why? Yeah, maybe the idea of like, why are we encouraging teens to kind of treat this as a fantasy? Like, what if my life was as tragic as this? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, like that is the thing. And that, you know, well, one, like we age and we learn in ways that are proportional to like our actual age and like developmental stages, right? So like it's natural to like have to graft oneself into like some sort of extreme other situation in order to feel things. Like, sure, mm-hmm. I understand. But it's just like, I don't know. It's just like, it's so fucking dramatic. Like, it is just really, and like most of us, like, yeah, I don't know. It's just maybe, and like, maybe that's fucked up to say that it's just so fucking dramatic, but it like, it really is just.
Well, maybe kind of some of the dramatism of their relationship goes against kind of the more grounded portrayal of being a teen with cancer that we see in the rest of the book. Like the relationship just feels melodramatic because a lot of her characterization is very grounded.
Yeah. And like, that's what, like, because I think this book does a good job of portraying disability in a very realistic, frank, and like empathetic way, right? Like where she talks about mm-hmm. like when they get on the plane to go to Amsterdam, she talks about how she walks, she decides to, instead of enduring like a pat down search, she disconnects from all of her equipment that helps her breathe so that she can mm-hmm. walk through the metal detector by herself.
Yeah.
And like she talks about feeling unencumbered, but also not being able to breathe, but also everybody looking at her, but also like she's like, I don't even know that this is what quote unquote normality feels like because it's been, you know, 5 years since I've even experienced that. Like, there's that really great balanced portrayal with my boyfriend's dying and he hasn't told me, and then I find out in this dramatic way and like we fuck, and then he essentially dies instantly. It like just this hardcore bent on catharsis, like, and it's, and yeah, it's just like it kind of goes to like, so right now, like, have you heard of like Colleen Hoover novels?
Yeah, I've just seen a lot of discourse both ways around them, but I've never read one.
So like the whole thing with Colleen Hoover novels is that it's like, from what I understand, because I have not read one either, but it's like, it's,
we should read one maybe.
Yeah, it could be fun on the Patreon. I think they're very easy to read. Like, I don't think there's a lot of labor involved with that. But it's, like, it's hardcore tragedy mixed with, like, romance. And, like, and in a lot of the situations, like, the romance is, like, toxic or abusive and, like, things like mm-hmm. that. And it's, like, it feels like I want people to have better literature. You know, like, if you come, if you're our age, you like read this book as a teen, and like maybe you're like all of like the people who I, you know, see posting reviews of Colleen Hoover books on their Instagram as if it is like something that you cannot buy at the grocery store, right? And like that's
I think like also like I guess as a, in a positive regard to this book, thinking about YA realistic tragedy porn, well, I guess normally your ghost does not come up and decide when you fall or if you stay, but like before I fall, if I stay, does this a lot worse? You know, as far as tragedy porn goes, this is definitely a way better portrayal of it than I think what a lot of these other teen YA books have been able to accomplish.
Yeah.
Because I think in some ways it grafts the dramaticness onto the relationship, not necessarily onto the death.
Yes, definitely. That's definitely,
and that works better for a teen book because that's what teens do. Like every relationship feels like it's life or death.
Right. And of course it does, but it's also like, yeah, I don't know. It's like, it's the equalizing of like catharsis, drama, darkness with literary value, right? Where it's like something is seen as having literary value and having the capacity to teach you something and give you ideas to engage in, when really it's just essentially tricking your body into having an emotional experience.
Yeah. That's fair. I mean, I wish I could go back and talk to my teen self, because I don't remember feeling as emotionally affected as by this as I did reading it, you know, yesterday. So I don't know. This book, you know, John Green, come on the pod. I couldn't find the clip about him or Hank talking about the clitoris, but I swear there's a gif. So someone, I feel like there's definitely a gif of Hank Green being like, touch, period, her, period, clitoris. If anyone knows what I'm talking about, I didn't make this up.
Please, the U.S. government and Homeland Security has wiped that from the internet because it was like causing people to like spontaneously like explode. It's just, it's the plight of the male feminist, you know what I mean? Where you're like, just shut the fuck up.
Yeah. If you're really a feminist.
If you're really a feminist, you would just like, it, you would just shut the fuck up.
Touch her clitoris.
Touch her clitoris. Yeah. Ugh, gross.
Ugh.
Don't do that. Don't, never touch her clitoris, dude.
Never touch that. No.
All right, well, thank you guys for listening. The book is a downer, so if you want to read it, do. If you don't, don't. I will not be picking this up again anytime soon. As always, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Girls Like Us Show. You can subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/girlslikeus. We will... Patreon.com/girlslikeusshow. We will be doing this movie on the Patreon sometime this month. So get subscribed for that. It's, I mean, like, look, I can't imagine. I mean, I haven't watched it yet. I can't imagine that I'm going to enjoy it. I do know that Willem Dafoe does play the author.
Yeah, reading it, I was like, I hope Philip Seymour Hall. I think he was passed away at this point. But
yeah, I think he was already out of commish. But yeah, so if you want to hear us cover the movie, that will be on the Patreon sometime this month. Our lovely producer is Camden Stacey, and our theme music is by the wickedly talented one and only Leggy. Have a great week, everybody.
Bye, y'all. Bye. Girls like us don't grow on trees.